This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. A hostage held in Gaza dies as work on a ceasefire deal continues between Israel and Hamas, a U.S. designated terrorist group. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
49-year-old Dror Or was one of about 250 people abducted by Hamas on a deadly attack on southern Israel on October the 7th. A day earlier, dozens of people demonstrated outside Israel's military headquarters in Tel Aviv, demanding a deal to release the hostages. Meanwhile, Hamas has said it is sending a delegation to Cairo to continue working on ceasefire negotiations. The talks come as thousands of students across the U.S. held demonstrations against Israel's offensive in Gaza. I'm Karen Chamas.
The United Nations Humanitarian Aid Agency says hundreds of thousands of people would be at imminent risk of death if Israel carries out a military assault in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. The city has become critical for humanitarian aid and is highly concentrated with displaced Palestinians. Leaders internationally have urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be cautious about any incursion into Rafah. The war has killed over 34,000 Palestinians in Gaza and driven around 80% of the population of 2.3 million from their homes. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said on Thursday he did not see any indication Hamas was planning an attack on U.S. troops in Gaza.
I don't see any indications currently that there is an active intent to do that.
A maritime pier constructed by the U.S. military should be open within a matter of days, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby said on Thursday. This is VOA News. Several U.S. universities are taking steps to prevent pro-Palestinian protest disruptions of graduation ceremonies this weekend. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Colleges are hiring extra security, they're screening attendees at venues, and they're warning that they won't allow protesters to disrupt the ceremonies. At the same time, they're pledging to honor free speech rights by designating protest zones. Thursday night, as the University of Utah president spoke at commencement, some students booed and yelled, "Free Palestine!" Northeastern University in Boston is holding commencement exercises on Sunday. Nearly 100 protesters were arrested there a few days ago. A university spokesperson says they acknowledge passionate viewpoints, but the focus this weekend, she said, should be on the graduates. I'm Rita Foley.
Germany accused Russia on Friday of launching cyber attacks on its defense and aerospace firms and ruling party, as well as targets in other countries, and warned there would be unspecified consequences. Russia's embassy in Berlin dismissed the accusations that were echoed by the Czech Republic, the NATO Defense Alliance, and the U.S. State Department. Russia calling them, quote, another unfriendly step aimed at inciting anti-Russian sentiments in Germany. NATO said the campaign had also targeted government bodies, critical infrastructure operators, and other entities in Lithuania, Poland, Slovakia, and Sweden. Britain's opposition Labour Party claimed a big early win against Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and his governing Conservative Party in local elections on Friday. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony reports.
The victory echoes recent polls, which indicate the beginning of the end of 14 years of Conservative rule and of Sunak's leadership.
We've got a billionaire Prime Minister.
Labour inflicted heavy losses on the Conservatives, securing a parliamentary seat in the northern English town of Blackpool and gaining control of several councils.
I declare that Christoph Paul Webb is duly elected as the Member of Parliament for the Blackpool South constituency.
The results set the tone for what will be two closely watched days of local results before a national election later this year.
Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony. Hope Hicks, a former White House aide to Donald Trump, took the witness stand on Friday in the former president's criminal trial, where she's expected to face questions about efforts during the 2016 presidential campaign to bury stories about his alleged sexual misbehavior. While the jury in the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president has heard accounts from outsiders, they have yet to hear testimony from people who work directly for Trump. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Something very unfortunate has happened in Burkina Faso in the last few days, where we've seen regulators suspending the British Broadcasting Corporation and the Voice of America, as well as, I believe, at least seven other media outlets.
Mutoki Mumo, Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking on World Press Freedom Day. Details coming up. Also, Chad's citizens vote Monday on whether transitional President Mahamat Idriss Deby stays in power. And a blockade by Islamic insurgents has isolated more than 140,000 people in the Malian town of Manaka. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. According to analysts, Chad's election on Monday is almost certain to result in victory for transitional president and military leader Mahamat Idriss Deby. In the run-up to the vote, authorities have cracked down on the media and opposition leaders have been kept off the ballot. Despite that, experts say Chad will remain an important ally for Western security efforts in the Sahel region. Henry Wilkins reports.
Mahamat Idriss Deby came to power after his father, Idriss Deby Itno, was killed on the front lines of Chad's war against the rebel insurgency in 2021. He appointed himself transitional leader and military ruler, a move critics say was unconstitutional. If Deby wins Chad's elections on May 6th, as analysts expect him to, he will legitimize his rule and become civilian president. Meanwhile, prominent members of the opposition party have been banned from appearing on the ballot and say speaking out against the government is risky. Avuksuma Dijona Adjanemu is leader of the Democratic Party. He says the group of leaders are taking a lot of risks by campaigning in this way. Having already covered the whole south of the country, he says they will now head to the country's hinterland to try to explain to voters that the results of the election will not be to their benefit and they won't solve any problems from the past.
We are taking a lot of risks and we don't know what will happen. We have already covered practically the entire south, and we will go back to the hinterland to try and explain to everyone that the results that will come out of this election are not for the Chadian population. It is not to solve anything about the past.
Cette élection, ce n'est pas pour la population chadienne, ce n'est pas pour résoudre quoi que ce soit par rapport au passé.
In February, one major opposition leader, Yaya Dillo, was killed by Chadian security forces. He said he was resisting arrest. His party said Dillo was assassinated. Analysts say Deby's influence is growing in Chad and beyond. Paul Menny is with the London-based think tank Chatham House.
Deby's importance as a security ally for France and for the US has been hugely enhanced by the developments in the center of the Sahel, because we've seen a series of military coups, of course, in West Africa.
Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, all of which were closely partnered with the West in the fight against militant groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State in the Sahel, have seen military coups in recent years, in part on a wave of anti-Western sentiment. Following the coups, Western troops were ejected. Chad has avoided such a coup. Ramaji Hoinathi is a Chadian analyst with the African think tank, the Institute for Security Studies. He says there is also a growing anti-Western sentiment in Chad. He says that at the same time, the state remains very, very pro-French and that the state is putting in place all possible means to prevent an anti-French movement from growing.
But at the same time, the state remains very, very pro-French, and the state is putting in place all possible means precisely to prevent an anti-French movement from growing.
While French troops remain in Chad, media reported on April 25th that US troops would leave, at least temporarily, or until the election is over. The US began pulling its 100 military personnel from the country in early May. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
As we mark World Press Freedom Day, Burkina Faso has suspended a number of radio networks operating in the country, including the Voice of America. The media outlets, according to Mutoki Mumo, Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, covered a Human Rights Watch report about atrocities the military allegedly committed in Burkina Faso against civilians. Mumo tells me that this is a common indicator seen in the region when journalists cover security-related stories that governments do not like.
As you've pointed out, something very unfortunate has happened in Burkina Faso in the last few days, where we've seen regulators suspending the British Broadcasting Corporation and the Voice of America, as well as, I believe, at least seven other media outlets, all of them international. And the reasons for the suspension is that these media outlets simply did their jobs. They covered a Human Rights Watch report about atrocities that were allegedly committed against civilians by the military in the country. So this is unfortunately an indicator of what we often see in this region when journalists particularly cover security affairs critically or touch on security personnel, the military, the police critically. Governments are quite often quick to retaliate. Perhaps not as always as extreme as in this way.
As CPJ's Africa Program Coordinator, how do you rate countries like Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, Somalia, and Egypt as far as press freedom?
So first of all, it's difficult to have a rating that cuts across all the countries that we cover simply because journalism is different in each of these countries. And as a consequence, the way in which journalists are repressed or are nurtured is also different in each one of these countries. But we can look at certain indicators that can sort of give us a temperature of the water, so to say, or a temperature of the situation for journalists in various countries in the Eastern Horn of Africa. And I often say, you know, as an East African, I personally am disappointed that this region often performs quite poorly on some of these major indicators. So if, for instance, if we look at imprisonment of journalists as an indicator, some of the worst detainers of journalists are in this corner of the world. You know, they include Eritrea, they include Ethiopia. And also when you look at other indicators like physical attacks on journalists, you know, you have countries in this region that have quite a negative, horrible records. And for example, we can see that as including Somalia, where so many journalists have been killed since 1992 when we started keeping track of this data. And though Kenya does not always rank very high when it comes to impunity for attacks, for killings of journalists, though those do happen, there are other ways in which the media in Kenya is restricted. And, we can, you know, the Eastern Horn of Africa region, you can see some trends. You can see that physical attacks and imprisonment of journalists are quite high in some countries like Ethiopia, like Somalia, like Eritrea. But then when you look at other countries, you can also see there are other ways, some more subtle, in which the media is silenced and which can be sometimes equally effective as an imprisonment or a physical attack.
To kind of balance the continent, West Africa, there have been reports of journalists being detained in Nigeria, for instance.
We continue to document, you know, violations against journalists in West Africa and in countries in that region. And also the Sahel, if I may talk about that, we've been worrying about what the media is going through in that region. Yes, in Nigeria, we have repeatedly documented detentions of journalists for varied amounts of time. We've also documented physical attacks. And what we've been calling for there is accountability for the attacks. We started speaking about Burkina Faso and, you know, the banning of the suspension of the international media outlets. But that act of censorship, unfortunately, is not entirely unique in that region. For instance, we can look at Mali earlier this year, where we saw the regulator issuing a directive asking all media to stop broadcasting and publication of political parties and activities of a political nature, which is quite a broad ban. And, you know, speaks to, again, the allergies that governments in sub-Saharan Africa seem to have for political coverage that covers the opposition or for political coverage that does not always favor them and is a trend seen perhaps in less extreme ways far beyond West Africa and the Sahel and is seen even in, you know, in parts of Southern Africa where journalists have recently been targeted, briefly arrested or assaulted for covering the opposition.
That was Mutoki Mumo, Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking with me from Nairobi. Save the Children says more than 140,000 people in the Malian town of Manaka, including 80,000 children, face malnutrition and disease due to a blockade by Islamic State-linked insurgents. The organization warns that the month-long blockade has driven supplies to alarmingly low levels as aid agencies and Malian government programs struggle to deliver basic necessities. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In a statement this week, Save the Children said that unless aid gets to Manaka communities soon, the area could see many deaths in the coming months. The London-based organization said some of its workers who went to assess the population's needs had been trapped for more than 3 weeks. The blockade in Manaka follows a siege in Timbuktu that began last August and has trapped more than 136,000 people, 74,000 of them children. In Timbuktu, however, some aid supplies are able to reach people in need, according to Save the Children. David Otto, a Nigerian-based security analyst, says the lack of government presence in northern Mali is complicating aid efforts.
Humanitarian activities within that region also has been very, very much limited, not just due to insecurity, which is one of the main factors, but also due to the fact that the regime or the military government has limited access to that region for humanitarian organizations on the basis that, you know, this is an area that is inhabited by, jihadist groups.
Aid agencies say Mali is locked in a complex crisis facing criminal organizations, an Islamist insurgency, socioeconomic challenges and climate change. More than 7 million people need humanitarian assistance, and the situation is worse in conflict-affected areas of northern and central Mali. According to CADRA Harmonized 2024, a framework used to identify food and nutrition insecurity in the Sahel and West Africa, over 40,000 residents of Manaka already face emergency levels of hunger. Aid agencies warned the situation is expected to deteriorate in June, by which time nearly 50,000 people will be food insecure and needing urgent support. Kevin Oduor teaches international criminal law at Technical University in Kenya. He says starving the population in Manaka is a war crime.
Blocking aid from getting to the people is tantamount to exposing them to murder, exposing them to situations that will hinder them from living their full lives. So these are actually war crimes.
Mali's military junta recently launched a joint operation with the military governments in Burkina Faso and Niger to fight jihadist and insurgent groups that has destabilized parts of West Africa. The junta says it sees the operations as one way of easing the suffering of its people in the hands of armed groups. However, the government has been unable to break the siege of either Manaka or Timbuktu. Meanwhile, the government has ordered the UN mission in Mali to close its offices and end the support it was providing to the population. Otto says saving lives and feeding its people is not a top priority for the military government in Mali.
The government is now focusing a lot on dealing with the security issues rather than actually looking at the humanitarian aspects within that area. So this is why you are seeing an increase in the number of people that, you know, are living in very dire circumstances within that region. Because right now the government is focusing on consolidating its power from a military and defense point of view rather than actually providing some kind of economic or sustainable assistance to these people living in this area.
Experts warn Mali's unwillingness to work with regional and international institutions may worsen the humanitarian situation in the country. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Nigeria is considering the introduction of state police across the country's 36 states as part of measures to tackle militant attacks, mass kidnappings, and banditry activities that have wrecked the country. The state police are an addition to the more than 300,000-member strong national police force who have been overwhelmed by the violence. Nigerians cautiously welcome the move, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
On the evening of October the 14th last year, Nigerian student Latifa Ibrahim, whose name we have changed to protect her identity, was on her way back to her off-campus lodge when five armed men abducted her along with two of her classmates in northern Nigeria's Ganju community. She says she could hear the struggles and screams of her friends as they were apparently raped by the kidnappers.
They actually did it in front of us, though our faces were covered. We were beaten there and were not treated nicely.
She says she was lucky to be spared by the rapists. The incident was reported to the police and school authorities. The trio were released 4 days later after their families separately paid ransoms. Ibrahim's family paid 5 million naira, or about $3,400, to the abductors for her release.
My families were stressed and worried. Like, it wasn't easy, especially my mom. She was so stressed.
Kidnapping for ransom is one of the major insecurities bedeviling Africa's most populous country amid the worsening economic crisis. Nigeria's inflation in February surpassed 31%, its highest level in three decades. Analysts say hostage taking by bandits is money-driven and that victims are mostly released once a ransom is paid. The Nigerian risk consulting firm SBM Intelligence said it has recorded 4,700 cases of abductions, mainly by militants and armed bandits, since President Bola Tinubu took office last May. Thousands more have been displaced from their homes by the violence. Nigerian security forces are also struggling to control a 14-year-long insurgency by the Boko Haram and the Islamic State West Africa Province extremist groups, deadly communal clashes, as well as separatist violence. To address the problem, Nigerian authorities agreed in February to set up state police units to bolster the national police force. Each Nigerian state would be empowered by law to coordinate and manage the force if the law is passed. The new legislation has yet to be approved by the Senate. Ordinary Nigerians say it is a good decision if properly managed. The Nigerian police force has the worst rating among 11 public institutions surveyed last year by the Afrobarometer, a pan-African research network. Allegations of brutality, extortion, and torture are frequently leveled against officers, a charge often contested by the police. However, police authorities often promise to investigate allegations and hold errant officers accountable. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Presumed Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump says if elected, he would restore a travel ban on some majority Muslim countries on the first day of his new administration. The travel ban was a controversial part of his first term as president and was rescinded by President Joe Biden. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
When Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, he pledged to change U.S. immigration to keep out terrorists from Islamic countries.
And we will keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country, 100%. We have no choice. We have no choice.
Once in office, Trump banned travel to the U.S. from seven majority Muslim countries, sparking protests and legal challenges, including from the American Civil Liberties Union. Attorney Lee Gellernt.
If there are real threats, then those threats should be investigated on an individual basis. But we shouldn't assume that any group or religion is more dangerous than another group.
The travel ban was argued all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where a conservative majority upheld it. in a move celebrated by Trump online and at the White House.
We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure.
Joe Biden campaigned against the Trump travel ban in 2020.
You know, you don't have to accept the president who promulgates hatred and exclusion toward Muslims and trumped up bans on travel bans on Muslims.
And ended that ban when he became president. Now, 4 years later, Trump told supporters in Wisconsin this week that events in the Middle East convince him that it's time for another travel ban.
We do not need a jihad in the United States of America. We do not need our once great cities to become hotbeds of terrorism. And on day one of the Trump presidency, I'm restoring the travel ban, suspending refugee admissions, and keeping terrorists the hell out of our country, like I had it before.
In this campaign, Biden has championed immigrant contributions to the United States, telling a group of campaign donors this week that other countries have suffered because they're xenophobic. Immigrants are what makes us strong, Biden said, because, quote, we have an influx of workers who want to be here and want to contribute. An April Harvard Caps Harris poll shows immigration tied with inflation as the top issues for U.S. voters. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Residents in Tanzania and Kenya are bracing for more severe weather after weeks of heavy floods have left more than 300 people dead in the two countries. Today, Kenyan President William Ruto postponed next week's planned reopening of schools until further notice. In a speech, Ruto said meteorological reports paint a dire picture because of the possibility of Cyclone Hidaya hitting Kenya in coming days. And now, time for sports. I have in studio with me our VOA sports analyst, intern Omole Mukale. He is here to fill us about the Champions League and recent NBA playoff drama that happened over the week. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Omole Mo.
It's good to be here.
So what are the results of the Champions League so far?
Yes, so in the Champions League semifinal, we had a really great game, Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid. The game ended up as a 2-2 draw, with Bayern Munich scoring from Leroy Sané and Harry Kane, and Real Madrid had Vinny Jr. with two goals. Furthermore, Borussia Dortmund versus PSG also happened over the week. That game ended off as a 1-0 with Borussia Dortmund scoring one, and Nicholas Füllkrug scored one for Borussia Dortmund.
And Omole Mo, crazy NBA playoff results. Did anyone get knocked out?
Yes, indeed. So for the East Coast Conference, Milwaukee got knocked out by the Indiana Pacers in a 4-2 series. And the New York Knicks beat the Philadelphia 76ers 4-2, putting the Indiana Pacers and the New York Knicks against each other in the semifinals. Moreover, Miami Heat got knocked out by the Boston Celtics in a 4-1 series, with the Celtics also advancing to the semifinals. Now for the West Coast Conference, the Oklahoma City Thunder sweeped New Orleans Pelicans. Also, the Minnesota Timberwolves sweeped the Phoenix Suns, putting both OKC and Minnesota in the semifinals. Also, Denver Nuggets beat the LA Lakers in a 4-1 series, putting the Denver Nuggets in the semifinals as well.
And finally, briefly, other exciting sports news that happened or that's coming up this weekend?
Yes, indeed. So for our BAL, we have the Sahara Conference starting tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're going to have the Union Sporting Monastirien versus the Armée Patriotique Rwandaise. That will be playing first tomorrow. And the Senegalese Association Sporting des Diones versus the Nigeria Rivers Hoopers basketball. If you guys want to listen to it, you can tune in at the voaafrica.com. Mike Hove and Jackson Mvunganye will be commentating on the game.
Excellent reporting. VOA sports analyst, intern Omole Mokale, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. voiceofamerica.africa.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.